You're listening to the theme of Living Well into the Future, our sister broadcast available on WTBRFM.com or wherever you get your podcasts. But instead of Living Well into the Future, we're going to present a two-episode special program. We were so blown away by We're Still Here, Indigenous Peoples of the Northeast, a month-long program of the University Days Committee of Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at Berkshire Community College in Western Massachusetts, that we're presenting two complimentary episodes also entitled We're Still Here, so you too can learn why and if the Indigenous Peoples of the Northeast are still here, and from whom, and how you can delve further into the issues. This is part one. Welcome to our Anthology of Insights from some of the artists, lecturers, and discussion and walk leaders who participated in We're Still Here, Indigenous Peoples of the Northeast, organized by the University Day Committee of Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at Berkshire Community College, chaired by Catherine M. Kidd. We hope it will lead you to investigate the topic further. From August 26th to September 29th, 2022, the committee presented four lectures, two art exhibits, a concert by Indigenous flute maker and player Hawk Henrys, five guided walks, and five book discussions to illuminate its theme, We Are Still Here, Indigenous Peoples of the Northeast. The committee introduced the local Berkshire community and the wider national and international audience participating via Zoom to perspective and insights not generally known. This is Julie Copenheffer. I'm your host for this program. The music that you will hear throughout this program is performed by Hawk Henrys. Hawk Henrys is a member of the Nipmuc community, a Native American community in Massachusetts. He performs on his handmade flutes and has performed with the London Mozart Players, with the New Orleans Jazz Festival, at the Tunica Biloxi Powwow, and at the Rotunda of the Museum of the American Indian. You can see the concert that he performed as part of the University Days events on the Berkshire Alle YouTube channel.
I'm Carol Almond Morton. I'm the new executive director for Alle, the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at Berkshire College. One of the things that's really exciting about Alle is that it's not only learners in the Berkshires, but we also have members all over the country and all over the world who study remotely with us.
Carol, can you tell us about the 2022 University Days events called We're Still Here?
University Days is a unique program within the Alle curriculum in that it is both inward-looking and outward-looking. So there are multidisciplinary, interdisciplinary programs that are developed by the volunteer committee that are intended to encourage our members to engage, but also some of them are designed to really invite in the larger community to participate, folks of all ages, not just older learners. It's also designed to get at an idea from as many angles as is reasonably possible. So that's something that's really special about this program in general. And in particular this year, I think that the committee went above and beyond in finding different types of ways to access with a mix of in-person and virtual programs with everything from art exhibits to walking tours to lectures, book discussions. It was with intention. We're really lucky that a lot of the people who are on the committee, and especially Kate Kidd in leading the committee, have a lot of experience in building curricula. I think one of the favorite things that Kate has mentioned to me is that when she was seeing the threads of people who were coming to multiple things and then coming up to her after and talking about how they see how things layer together was so important and powerful for her. And I think that was also true for me. The reason it was called We Are Still Here, it was about making what had been rendered invisible, visible, right, in communities across New England.
Thank you, Carol Almond Morton. Dr. Drew Lopenzina is professor of Early American and Native American Literature at Old Dominion University in Virginia. His studies focus on the presence of indigenous peoples in the colonial Northeast. He has written three books on the subject, one of them, Through an Indian's Looking Glass, a cultural biography of William Apis Pequot, is the subject of his lecture. Drew Lopenzina was one of the distinguished lecturers. You can see his full lecture on the Ali YouTube channel and hear my full interview of him on the WTBRFM.com website. Drew Lopenzina, you have written and studied Native American literature. How did you become interested in the area?
I was in graduate school. 9/11 was happening. Remember, this was a traumatic event for America. We had been invaded. And I remember as we were going through it and living through it, there was this dark side to it as well, where there was this anti-Muslim sentiment that really rose up during the time. And that morphed into an anti-immigrant sentiment that I think we're still living in so many ways today. And it got me thinking about this kind of litmus test about what it means to be an American and where did these ideas come from? How are they voiced so confidently that this is what it means to be an American? And there seems to be some kind of paradoxical element to it. And I started going all the way back as I'm pulling on that thread to early American literature. And I saw a lot of these questions or stances that we have about American identity are being formed in that early period. And I don't think that's surprising for a lot of people, but if they're being forged against the Native Americans who are there, and that this battle of identity as Native Americans are being seen as irrelevant and being pushed out. And I really wanted to understand it from the Native American point of view. And I think that's what led me to flip the table and say, how can we see it from this lens?
When you decided to undertake this project, what were the sources? Where did you find your material to study this?
It took time to indoctrinate myself into what I was doing. There was so little work on it at the time, and I was riding a learning curve the whole way. And at first, I was really reliant on texts by early American writers, looking all the way back to people like John Smith and John Winthrop and William Bradford and Roger Williams and all of these early settler texts, and they generated so much literature. And it's fascinating to read their literature and see how they contradict themselves at times, and particularly when they're talking about natives, how they're contradicting themselves. And one thing I saw repeated over and over again is that native people were people without law, without religion, without history, and without culture. And that catchphrase, that to repeat that over and over again, really reduced Native American people to the level of like animals, of beasts in the forest, basically. And you would see those kind of ideas over and over again. But at the same time, you would have these encounters that they're also describing where Native people are treated as they have a real diplomatic way about them, that they're actually great speakers and they're very tolerant. And you can see them actually lobbying for peaceful relations in these documents that are at the same time referring to Native people as savages. So you would look for those sort of contradictions, and that I built off of those a lot. But then the more I started to read of Native scholars who were just coming to the fore at the time, people like Robert Warrior and Lisa Brooks, who I believe is one of the speakers you've had in the series, Marge Bruchak also. And these people from a Native scholarly perspective were introducing me to a lot of new forms of how Native people were communicating their cultural ideas and their values. And the more I began to understand it from that perspective, the more I was able to see how those values were being worked through in some of these colonial texts that I was looking at.
So you started with the colonial figures in America. Were they all British?
No, I looked at some of the French Jesuit tracts as well, and I was looking at some of the early Spanish colonization efforts going all the way back to Christopher Columbus. And so it's really fascinating. I think they all repeated some of the same motifs, how Native people had no history, no culture, no religion, which is always false. Native people actually had highly developed spiritual systems of thought. They were really actually great curators of their own history. And they had culture and civilization. One of the first things that gets erased is always agriculture. Native people are viewed as they had no agriculture of their own. They lived it like the beasts in the forest. But what we always forget is that when the Puritans first came here, they settled on cleared fields. They talk about it. This place had been cleared and there was still Indian corn growing. And it'd be a surprise to some people, but even Columbus in his journals, I found a passage where Columbus talks about going past one island and they're just going past about what he counted as like 300 acres of growing corn. Maize is actually a word that comes from the Caribbean, that sort of catch-all. We say maize is the Indian word for corn. Well, there are like 500 different Indian languages, but it actually comes from the Caribbean. And so these were people who were practicing agriculture already. And the word culture is right there in agriculture, right? They were a cultured people. They were a people with civilization. They did grow crops and sustain themselves. And just to add one more thing to that, that none of the colonists from Spanish to French to English to Dutch could have survived at all without native agriculture. They all depended on surplus native agriculture for their own survival.
You mentioned when we spoke earlier that there were several colleges, including Harvard, and Dartmouth, too, that were formed to educate the Native Americans in our way of thinking.
Right? Yeah, right. So the encounter with the colonists that's starting sometime in the early 17th century, they quickly realized that in order to engage with these people, we have to learn their ways. And so now when the colonists came, they had their mandate. It was written in their charters at Jamestown, at Plymouth, and Massachusetts Bay Colony, which is today Boston. They all said one of their chief reasons for coming here was to bring Christianity to the natives. It's always either the first or second point in their official charters. And so they'd always come around to that. And their idea, particularly for the Puritans, was to convert the natives. You had to educate them first. It was a tenet of Puritan belief that you had to be able to read the Bible and have firsthand experience with it. You didn't want middlemen, you know, and you didn't want it in Latin. And so They took this idea and they decided we need to educate the natives on how to read English writing. And the natives were interested in this as well. So they would send representatives of their community. And this first happened for Harvard College. So Harvard is, I guess, officially established sometime in the 1640s. And in the charter of the college, it says our first reason for being here is to bring Christian light to those who have forever sat in hellish darkness, as they say. From the Harvard point of view, they enlisted these native people. From an indigenous point of view, it was their cultural practice. We'll send a couple of our best sons to this establishment so that they can learn these ways. So you have native people, particularly Wampanoag, Nipmuc, and perhaps Narragansett as well, all taking classes at Harvard. And by 1662, one of them had graduated. Another one was about to graduate, but he died before he could actually get there. But to graduate from Harvard, that meant they had to be able to speak Latin, Hebrew, Greek, along with English, which of course is still a second language for them. So they had to master all these languages. They had to master physics and astronomy. And it's, we don't imagine native people doing this in the 1600s, but Chishatamock, we have a letter from him that he wrote a thank you letter basically to the benefactors back in England who paid for his education. And it's written in Latin, and it's the earliest example that we have of a native person writing in what is today the United States. It's the earliest document that still exists. And it's written in Latin, of all things. It's really bizarre. And so what I found is there's a lot of documents like this. Native people are engaging with literacy. They're going to colleges like this. It's a failed experiment. If Native people are going there to just gain information and learn how to deal with the English diplomatically, the English are really out to create a hegemonic society that you have to become a Christian and you have to change your ways and get rid of your old heathenish ways, so to speak. And Native people didn't want any of that. And so it was always a fraught relation. But nevertheless, Native people were going to college. Dartmouth was the same thing. It was instituted originally as a college that was supposed to, when the funds were raised for Dartmouth, the idea was that it was going to be an Indian college for Indian students, if you will. And the money raised to found Dartmouth College was raised by a Native American. He was a Mohegan named Samson Occam, who traveled to England in 1665, I believe, and he toured around and he was an ordained minister and he collected money and he ultimately collected £12,000, which in today's currency would be about $2.5 million. And that was the seed money to start Dartmouth. And once he returned to the colonies and he handed over this money to the people who had coordinated all of this, they took that money and they moved it up to Dartmouth and they decided, let's make this a school for white students instead. And they completely left the Mohegan and all the other people who were invested in this enterprise, left them hanging out to dry.
Interesting. How is the memory of the literacy and intent of the indigenous people suppressed?
That's a great question. I think it's suppressed through rhetorical means. If you keep hammering at a certain idea, Native people are savage. They have no law, no tradition, no culture, no history. Most people would be, even today, very comfortable with that sort of characterization of Native people. You may think Native people were like they had this beautiful connection to the earth or something, or that they were noble and that they were brave and all these things, but you don't think of them as people who have their own literature and their own history and their own spiritual values that they still practice to this day. And so this is what happened over time. I refer to this in my writing as unwitnessing, where you see colonial people, they see Native people have spirituality. They see that Native people have laws. They see that they have customs. They even, English people are participating in those customs quite often. You keep repeating the mantra over and over again. No history, no religion, no culture. They're not civilized. And if you repeat it enough over a period of 300 years, it trickles upward and we've absorbed and internalized those notions. And Native voices have not overall really been loud enough to puncture through that myth and to allow us to see it from another perspective. That's how I envision my work, is trying to bring that perspective to a public that may be receptive to it, but really hasn't heard it. This is not how we were brought up to understand how things were.
Thank you, Dr. Drew Lopezina. You can hear Dr. Lopezina's lecture on the Berkshire Ali YouTube station, and you can hear the full interview that I did with him on WTBRFM.com. Now we will turn to Judy Dow. Judy Dow was one of the three Indigenous women artists featured in the exhibit A Wick Again, Evoking Indigenous Stories and Landscapes. It was displayed at Shakespeare and Company in Lenox, Massachusetts. Judy Dow is of Abenaki and French-Canadian descent. She teaches science, history, and math through art. Judy, welcome. You've just taken a 4-hour drive to get to Lenox. Where are you coming from?
I live in Essex, Vermont.
Is that a place where your family has lived for years?
My family has lived in the Burlington area for about 9 generations that we've documented. And we lived there from October to April. And from April to October, we lived on an island, South Hero, in the Lake Champlain. And we would travel back and forth each year. And when we lived in South Hero, all my aunts and uncles, cousins, and grandparents all lived in the same dirt, dead-end road. So I grew up in a little community.
And that community, was that Indigenous land, or had it been?
Yes.
And is it still?
No, it's been gentrified.
How do you use your art to teach science, history, and math?
So a lot of that educational program I do is getting students to read the land and tell the untold story. What's not told about this land? What has been told, but only one perspective told? And with kids, sometimes it's easy to do it with felt. And so we make these tapestries. And so, for instance, if you go to a website called From Small Beginning, you'll see my tapestries on eugenics. Last year was 100 years from the second International Annual Conference. And at the second International Annual Conference, on the brochure, they had a tree. And the roots were all these different things that they claimed was the right way to go for eugenics. So I duplicated that tree in felted wool because I knew in September, it was going to be 100 years. I didn't know what I was going to do with it, but I duplicated it. And then I said to myself, oh, damn, this is bad. I need to do something that shows the good side of this. So I duplicated the tree in different colors and called it the wisdom tree. So it was all about anti-eugenics, and the roots were filled with things that you could do to fight eugenics. And so the two trees are on an international tour now. They've been in, oh my God, London and Warsaw and all different places. They're going all around the world.
You told me that 632 members of your family were affected by the eugenics movement.
623. From 1925 to 1936, Vermont ran a program called the Vermont Eugenics Survey. And the program was to identify people they believed to be defective, dependent, and delinquent. And it was all subjective. And it was a progressive party who believed that they could produce better people. And they believed that separating the children from their families would help that happen. The children would be raised differently. And so my family was the largest family targeted in the records. They went back many generations to get names of people, and they institutionalized many. They sterilized some. My grandmother was picked up off the street and institutionalized. And for 5 years, my grandfather never knew what happened to her, so he filed for divorce, thinking she abandoned him. And during that time, my father was little. He was like five. So he was put in an orphanage because my grandfather couldn't work and watch a five-year-old. So there was a lot of traumas that happened during that period of time. And when I first started doing all this research, I found out that my grandmother was in an institution. She was alive until my father was 16. He never even knew it, and neither did my grandfather.
Has there been any accounting or accountability on that?
Yeah, UVM was like the center of this program. Henry Perkins was the executive director. He was a professor at the University of Vermont, and he coordinated the program from there. And the state sponsored it. And the university gave an apology, but they never apologized for anything except that people suffered. And the state made an apology as well, but that too is questionable. And the state is working to develop a program for truth and reconciliation right now.
You are the head of an organization. Could you tell me the name of the organization, what its purpose is?
It's called Gedakina, and Gedakina means our world or our worldview. And we work with women and their families to help self-determine a good path in life. So we have all these groups all over New England, and we have a leader in each group who reclaims history of beading techniques or basketry techniques or gardening techniques, anything that will help women to self-determine a good path in life. And so then we have stores, or we help them to get set up on Etsy so they can support themselves with their work. And we have gardens in Vermont that grow heirloom seeds. And then we supply seeds for the gardens all over so they can continue with growing the heirloom seeds. And then they learn how to can, how to dehydrate, how to freeze, and how to get the food preserved so they can provide for their families.
Are you using techniques that come from indigenous culture, trying to recapture them in this process,
bring
back some knowledge?
Yep. So saving the seeds is a traditional practice, and we've done that for years, growing in the format of using the three sisters, where the three sisters help each other. The corn provides the stock for the beans to grow up, and then the beans are nitrogen fixers. They put the nitrogen back into the soil. And then around the perimeter, you put the squash, and the squash are picky to touch. So they keep away the predators like the raccoons from the corn. And plus they grow big and sprawl and they prevent the soil from drying out. And we've added a fourth sister, sunflowers. We position the sunflowers in our gardens as windbreaks to prevent the corn from being blown over in these big summer storms. And they also draw the heavy metals out of the soil. So we've also reclaimed a lot of techniques for controlling pests like squash bugs and stuff like that. We've reclaimed that. And then we do new things as well. We adapt and we have varying gardens. We might have a salsa garden, and then the ladies will learn to make salsa and they'll can it. And then later in the fall, they'll have a salsa party. So there's lots of things we do like that. Yeah.
Your work is on display at Shakespeare and Company in Lenox, Massachusetts, and has been shown widely. What response do you get from people about your work?
The most common comment is, how does your brain work? Nobody even thinks that way. People say all the time, like when I, how can I explain it to you? Let me show you. Can you see that?
I certainly can.
Okay, so this is the story of my backyard. So in the middle, there's a meadow and a meadow and a forest. And either end of the meadow, we have birds. See the bird beak?
Yes, absolutely.
Porcupine and snails.
So you have a visual language, a symbolic and visual language.
Yeah.
That people may not know what it is, but will respond to.
Exactly. Exactly. And so when I explain the story in my mind, I've created this mnemonic device to tell the story in my backyard. And that's what I try to get kids to do. Tell the story of their, like, whatever the land is they're reading. And we do research. I'm working with students. We'll do research as to how did this mountain get here? When did this mountain get here? Why is this mountain here? And so then they can tell the story in some kind of art. To me, it's not like art. It's like a map to tell the story.
When the LA audience is looking at your art, what should they keep in mind? How can they shift their perspective to understand the story that you're telling?
How can they do it? They need to come with an open heart and a clear mind. If they come with an open heart and a clean mind, they will see another perspective. And then they will eventually see balance in the middle.
Thank you, Judy Dow.
You're welcome.
Listeners can see Judy Dow's work and hear more of her descriptions as well as her lecture at the Berkshire Alley YouTube channel. More information about Judy Dow's work can be found on the Berkshire Alley website under the University Days 2022 tab. A second exhibit included in the University Days program featured the work of Indigenous artist Niana LaFond, entitled The Missing and Murdered Indigenous Peoples Project. Niana has painted more than 80 larger-than-life portraits, over 50 of which were on display at the Lichtenstein Center for the Arts in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. Niana, you have an exhibit up here. Could you tell me the genesis of the project?
Sure, and thank you for speaking to me about this. It's the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Peoples Painting Project is the name that it has taken on, but it started not as a project. It started as one painting. During COVID on May 5th, 2020, I created one painting as catharsis, as a survivor of domestic violence and coming from a family of intergenerational trauma against Indigenous women. I painted one piece called Lorena in red of a woman named Lorena Bear from Saskatchewan. And that piece I shared with an online community of over 100,000 Indigenous people called Social Distance Powwow.
Social Distance Powwow.
Yes, it's a Facebook group. And I shared it with them, and the response overnight was overwhelming. I had over 3,000 reactions. I was stuck at home in COVID, so I thought, I'll do another. I did another, and I got even more reactions. So I decided, you know, I'm kind of stuck here with nothing of it. I want something to do. I will open my email and let people know that they can contact me, and I'll paint them for free. And I received 25 in the first day.
And these are people, indigenous peoples all over
Turtle Island, which is North America, so the U.S. and Canada. I actually have been reached out to groups in other countries, and I'm considering doing other projects for them. But this particular symbolism is unique to North America.
Ah. And did you grow up with indigenous part of your background?
My mother and her family are First Nation and Aboriginal Canadian. So I am of Anishinaabe and Mi'kmaq and Métis descent.
And is that southern?
That is northern Ontario and Nova Scotia.
Ah. And you say Aboriginal, so that predates the first peoples.
It's actually a jurisdictional issue. Métis people are characterized as all, and First Nation has its own category. So I have to designate between the two because I am both of those things, but from different lines of my family. So I like to acknowledge both sides.
And you mentioned that domestic violence was something that has affected your life. Is that something you saw growing up? And then is it multi-generational?
It is multi-generational. It was a normal thing, unfortunately, and it is in many Indigenous families and cultures, where it started with my great-grandmother, who was attending the Spanish residential school in Ontario when she was impregnated at 13 and forced to marry the 34-year-old who was abusive. He took her away from her family, and they had more children, etc., and that really started the level of acceptance that the women in my family were willing to entertain.
So your great-grandmother...
My great-grandmother was...
Was a person who was removed from her family and...
Yes, and put into the Spanish residential school. And that's where she was impregnated and had her first child, Roseanne. And my grandmother was a few children after that. And as a result of growing up in that environment, my grandmother then moved on to have her own domestic violence situation. My mother also moved into really destructive behaviors of substance abuse and things of that nature. And she created a home filled with domestic violence that I grew up in, but it was through her. And as a result, as an adult, I didn't recognize it when I saw it. And I ended up in an 18-year relationship.
I see. And what gave you the strength to remove yourself from it?
A 5-year-old little girl and cancer. I had leukemia and a bone marrow transplant and almost died several times to go home to experience more and almost die again from other things. And when you go through that and you have a new lease on life and you realize that you came very close to death, I'm the only person who I met at that time period who was having a transplant who's still here. You reassess things and you're no longer afraid of the things you were afraid of before that kept you there.
Did you name the exhibit?
Yes, it's called Portraits in Red.
And what does that name come from?
Each of the paintings does become my signature style before this project. I can paint in color. I choose not to because my photography was also black and white. And it's where my heart is in that language. But in red is the only visible color, because red is the only color that spirits can see according to most Indigenous belief systems. So that's where the portraits in red came from. I was just trying to come up with something to tie them all together, and it seemed appropriate to tie it back to that color that means so much.
Do you start with a photograph? Do you start with a likeness of the...
Yes, I work from photographs. It started in COVID, so I was not leaving my apartment at the time. And a lot of them, this is the only photograph they have of their loved one. So I have to work with whatever I get.
Each one has a powerful story. So you're living with each one of these people.
Very literally, because I work from home and they occupy an entire room. When they're home, they're not. They're all here right now. I talk to their families. I hear their story and I try to process that through the art. And I use it as a way of catharsis for myself as well. So I'm thinking about their story. I'm thinking about the person while I'm painting them. But I'm also thinking about my own experiences and trying to use the canvas as therapy. It's also become therapeutic to some of the families involved. They've said that it has helped them to be acknowledged, to have their loved one's face out in the world, to have their story being told.
As I look around the room, these disappeared Indigenous people are from all over, and this is not ancient history.
No, this is current.
So when we think about disappeared people, and especially Indigenous people, we think it's in the past. But
I have noticed that misconception a lot, especially in what pieces seem to get featured more, because the ones that are featured more seem to be the ones that look like they are from the past. Through talking to families, and especially some of the people I'm painting now are being found murdered after I even started this project, and I'm only 2.5 years into it. And some of these people's bodies were found recently. The conclusion that I'm coming to is every moment someone is going missing, and that as we're speaking, there's someone going missing or their body's being found or something like that. There are families represented here who I've painted, 5 of their family members, some of whom after I had already painted others, and their bodies were then found later.
And it's not only women.
No, it is not. It is also men and two-spirit individuals, which is the Indigenous term for trans. And it does not, you know, people who or spouses who will hurt you, they do not discriminate based on anything. So I don't either. I don't exclude people based on whether or not they're enrolled on their gender or their self-identity. We are all humans and we're experiencing this. And what ties it together is that we're Indigenous and the things that come with that.
You've been doing it for 2.5 years now. What would you like the action and reaction of people to be to this very powerful series?
I would like people to think about their own families and how it would affect them if this happened. I would like people to take whatever action that they can take, whether it's sharing the information, photograph the work, and share it to social media. I'm more than happy for that to happen. And talk about it and seek out other artists, because I'm not the only one making work about this topic, and learn more and participate and write to legislators, change some of these laws. Go to these things and be support to the Indigenous community, because there are more and more events popping up and more people talking about it. So we're building traction now.
Thank you, Nyana Lafond. More information about Nyana Lafond's work can be found on the Berkshire Ollie website under the University Days 2022 tab. My interview with her will be found on the WTBR-FM website. Exploratory walks were another element of the University Days program. In this installment, we'll speak with Russ Cohen, who conducted a foraging expedition
at the Bidwell House in Monterey, Mass. Russ?
What role did indigenous peoples play in your knowledge of plants?
There's at least three things I'm grateful to indigenous people about when it comes to foraging. And the first one is the knowledge itself. When you're talking about all the native species that I'm interacting with, that I'm nibbling on, figuring out what was edible and how to prepare and eat it, that was all done by the indigenous people that lived in this region for thousands of years. And I'm really grateful that information has continued to this day to the extent that I could learn it and share it with other people. Also with that knowledge is a respect for nature and a reciprocity with nature, so that I learned that you have to approach anything you might pick from the natural world in a very respectful way and consider its role in the ecosystem, its role as food or other values to the wildlife and birds that we share the earth with, to make sure that you don't upset the ecological balance in any way when you're harvesting them. And that is very strongly embedded in Native American culture. And I'm happy to also follow that very sound advice. And then third thing is that the presence of a lot of our edible species in our environment are due to the tending of the landscape by Native Americans, who fire was their primary technique, but they would also move seeds around and plant plants in places where those species be useful to grow. So good example of that is actually my number one favorite edible species, the shagbark hickory, which if you look at a range map for that species, that it extends quite far north in the Northeast, up into Quebec, way out into down East Maine, and ethnobotanists that I have studied are pretty firmly convinced that that species is there because Native Americans deliberately moved and planted that plant to grow in those spots so that it was available for them to harvest the nuts and so on. So I'm grateful to all the tending of the landscape Native Americans have done that have helped foster the thriving of the edible wild plants and other useful plants that we encounter in our landscape today.
So you are not indigenous yourself?
No.
So did this information get filtered down through people who wrote the books that you studied?
When I started in the 1970s, I'd have to say that it was a time when Native Americans weren't getting full credit for their important role in acquiring the knowledge originally, and their respect and their practicing the forbearance and restraint that they practice as they're interacting with plants to make sure the plants aren't harmed by collecting them. And I'm very grateful to express my appreciation now, but I'm not sure I knew it that well back when I started this information. But I do have to say that my knowledge and my practice of this subject, it feels like it's evolved in kind of a parallel track to indigenous knowledge and interaction with these plants without being taught directly by Native Americans.
As you may know, there's a whole chapter in Braiding Sweetgrass about this called the Honorable Harvest.
Yeah.
Lagerwal Kimmerer presents basically this list of questions to ask before you do the process that I say it's basically the Ten Commandments of foraging. And she suggests in that chapter that people ought to put this on a laminated card and take it with them outdoors. And anytime they think about picking anything, go through that process. And I think that would be a good thing to do. And I follow a similar way of interacting with plants. When I teach plants, be respectful and to not take too much, and gentle to respectful is also something I have to acknowledge and express my gratitude to Native Americans for helping to guide me in what I do.
Thank you, Russ Cohen.
Welcome, Michael Forbes Wilcox.
How many years ago did you start teaching classes about indigenous peoples and culture?
Probably about 3 years ago. It was just before the pandemic started.
Oh, so you've done walking classes, you've done book reviews, you've done other selections. I can't even list all the classes that you've done. What has the interest been and how have people reacted to what you're teaching?
Yeah, the reception has been very positive and gratifying. And I maybe have been given credit for getting Ali on this track, which I'll accept that, the kudos there. But the truth is that the interest is out there, and not just in Berkshire County, but I think that you see evidence of it growing throughout the country and the world, in fact, of Indigenous people and their practices and learning from them. And Simon Winchester, for example, wrote a book recently, his most recent book called Land. And he talks a lot about how can you own the land. And he goes around the world and talks to Maori people and those stories of places all around the world where Indigenous people are coming into their own, as it were, and the recognition being given to them that they really maybe knew more than the Europeans did about how to manage land. But anyway, I hope that I contributed to satisfying some of the interest, but I don't think I generated. I think that people are just, the consciousness everywhere is being raised about the value of Indigenous wisdom.
What have you learned? We started at the beginning saying that you learn as much as you teach when you do these things. What have you learned through these series of university day events that you might not have otherwise known?
I guess I could answer that in the specific, a lot of specifics that I learned, of course. And just to give you a couple examples of that, I think that Lisa Brooks presented one of her lectures, Marge Bruchak, who is, by the way, the aunt of my language teacher, Jesse, Marge Bruchak, who is, those two are both Indigenous and identify as Abenaki, and they're college professors who have written extensively. And I learned so much from them, from their works, from their written works, and from their lectures. And so I'm very grateful for that. I think that was one thing that Ali did that was remarkably good, to bring them into the, and others too. I don't mean to exclude the other contributions, but those two for me stand out as being the most enjoyable and informative people that I remember throughout this program. And I guess for me, the overarching thing that I've learned from this is that there is a better way. When I look at our culture today, which is capitalist and competitive, these things are rated highly. And when you look at the results, I think they're not so good. And I think that when you look at the Indigenous culture, it was cooperative, not competitive. Community was everything. And I don't mean to extol their virtues too. There were certainly flaws in their system. There were certainly people who misbehaved. It wasn't like a perfect world. But I think the philosophy of sustainability, respect for nature and for each other, and reciprocity, taking care of each other, I think those are values that our culture would do well to practice more of.
Are there any other programs that you would like to lead or bring to the Ali table in the future? Have we exhausted the subject?
Oh, no, not by any means. And in fact, that's perhaps another thing that I've learned as I've gotten into my studies here about Indigenous matters. When I first started, I wasn't aware of a lot of what I've learned since then. And as I began to nibble away at the things that I didn't know, I began to realize that for everything I was learning, there were probably 10 things that I learned that I didn't know about. So I think that, and I became aware of the enormous literature that's out there, both historically and currently. There are many books being written by Indigenous authors, and that's something that's fairly new. There have always been Indigenous authors, but they were, pointed out earlier, not encouraged at all. They were suppressed in many ways. And they were courageous for doing what they did. And now that it's more acceptable, then the floodgates have opened and you're seeing like the TV series Reservation Dogs. You heard about that. And that's one example of
This morning there was an article about a Finnish author who has written about the Plains or Desert Indians, Americans.
Yeah. So I think the available material is exploding, but there was already a treasure trove out there that I was not aware of. And to give you just one little local example, on our walk the other day, my friend Ray was there and he asked me, not during that walk, but later, if I knew what the origin of the word Ashuwillatuk, that's the rail trail a little bit north of you and Adams and Cheshire and so on. And I did not know the origin of it. I started to look into it and gotten a lot of clues, but I first thought it was not a Mohican word because it has an N. Mohican is what is called an H dialect, meaning they have no R's or L's. But as we started to delve into this, I realized that the original document where this name was taken from did not have an L on it either. So it probably is a Mahican word. But I'm still not sure what it means, but I'm getting there. And so it's been fun for me to come up with names like that or questions from people and try to track them down, doing a little detective work. That sort of appeals to my interest in detail. But again, I'm really more interested in the big picture because I think that's where the opportunity is the greatest for us to benefit from the indigenous people.
Now for a final word, let's hear from Kate Kidd, whom we have heard about throughout this program.
When I gave the walking tour in Stockbridge, I said, how many of you can envision the Stockbridge of Norman Rockwell? Of course, everybody raised their hand because everybody sees pictures. I said, how many of you can envision the Stockbridge of the wealthy cottagers? So the Choates and the Fields and all of these other people. And everybody can imagine that because that's still what you see when you walk down the street in Stockbridge. And I said, how many of you can envision Stockbridge as it was founded as a home for Native Americans? Not one person raised their hand. So I said, what I hope will happen with this tour is that the next time you walk down Main Street or drive down Main Street in Stockbridge, that you will be able to envision a wigwam right over here on the lawn of what's now the former Sedgwick home, or that you can envision the Native American school right on the edge of the property of Austin Riggs, so that instead of being invisible, that the Stockbridge Munsee ancestors and their footprint in this place will become visible to you.
So that leads to my last question. Tell me what feedback you're getting in general, what you're hearing from the participants.
I think what we're hearing a variety of things. Number one is we want more of this, which has been very exciting because I thought we might have saturated the market with these intensive events. So that's been one thing. A second thing has been people have responded so positively to the cultural connections. And I was hoping that would be the case because, it can be very depressing to learn about how our settler ancestors, our colonial ancestors, treated Native Americans. And so I didn't want it to be a story of injustice without a response, or I didn't want it to be a story of Native Americans being victimized and that it ended there. I think what's really important and what I really wanted people to see is that Native Americans have always been adaptive. They have always had a complex culture. They have always been able to live in both worlds, even though we wanted them to either choose to be Native American or choose to be Western like the rest of us. And I wanted people to see the positive aspects of their culture. And yes, we recognize the victimization, but this is a positive culture that we need to learn about and we need to honor. And I think what's been exciting is people, by the time they've gone to two or three things, they're like, oh my gosh, I had no idea about this. I had no idea about that. And oh, this was so exciting. And she's such an amazing artist. And we've had some textile artists who've come and have said these quilts could compete with anything that's being created in the quilting community today. And what the quality that people see in the work that's being done by Native American communities, the quality of the scholarship, the quality of the children's books that have been written in recent years. People are just, they're excited. They're very excited.
Thank you, Kate. We'll hear more from Kate and from Michael Wilcox, who led walks and book discussions during the course of the University Days program, as well as from other members of the University Days Committee in our next installment. Thank you to our guests, Drew Lopenzina, Judy Dow, Niana LaFond, Russ Cohen, Carol Allman Morton, and Catherine M. Kidd. You can access more information on our guests and the topics addressed at BerkshireOLLI.org. That's BerkshireOLLI.org. Look under the University Days 2022 tab and at the Berkshire OLLI YouTube channel. You can find more information in the books, articles, and albums of the participants. Thanks to the members of the University Day Committee, Catherine M. Kidd, Michael Wilcox, Barbara Grill, Ellen Crobier, and Victoria Orlovsky, as well as WTBR-FM Pittsfield. Our music is by Hawk Henrys and is used with permission. This program is produced by Julie Copenheffer. Opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and not of WTBR, Berkshire OLLI, the production team, or the University Days Committee.